This interview of Wisdom from the Top was recorded in 2020. From Luminary Built in Productions and NPR, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, the story of Terry Lundgren and Macy's.
Taking that risk, in fact, to me, was safer than not taking a risk by not changing. That to me, was an even bigger risk.
How Terry Lundgren doubled down on retail and made Macy's the largest department store in U.S. history. So for most of the 20th century, most U.S. cities had at least one iconic department store. In Boston, it was Filene's. In Chicago, Marshall Field's. Philadelphia had Wanamaker's. In Milwaukee, it was Gimbel's, and so on. They had marble floors and glass atriums and glamorous tea salons. And these stores all had strong regional identities. They catered to their regional customers. But by the early 21st century, as e-commerce started to disrupt traditional retail, many of these stores couldn't survive on their own and became part of bigger national chains, particularly Macy's. And the idea to create a national department store chain was largely Terry Lundgren's. Terry was instrumental in turning Macy's into the biggest department store brand in the world. At one point under his leadership, the company's stock hit an all-time high. Today, of course, the retail landscape is much, much more challenging. A downward trend Terry started to see towards the end of his time at Macy's. Terry grew up in a family of six kids in Orange County, California. He was a pretty good student, but in college at the University of Arizona, he spent a lot less time on academics and a lot more time on his social life, until one day of his junior year when he received an unexpected phone call from his dad.
And he said, "Son, I saw your report card." And the guy said, "Oh, yeah." I said, you know, those professors have it out for me. You know, they're just not giving me a chance." And I started having all these stupid excuses. And he said, "Well, I'm sorry about that." He said, "Listen, your mom and I have talked about this, and we are no longer able to fund your education." And I remember saying to him, "Dad, you don't understand. You're ruining my life." And he just a little pause at the end. I could hear my mom, like, I think she was crying a little bit in the background. My dad said, "Son, if that's how you choose to see it, it's you who's made the decision to ruin your life, not me." And I was like, "Whoa, okay." Got the message and hung up the phone and started thinking about, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Long story short, I went to apply for jobs and remember going into this restaurant called the Solarium Restaurant. Became a waiter and then a head waiter, and I became manager of that restaurant.
So you graduate and you work in the restaurant for a while, and it sounds like you were sort of, you know, going to pursue a job, you know, at a big company. You were looking around, and I guess you got an offer to go work for Xerox, which in the sort of the mid 70s, like, that was a place to go. I mean, that was like going to Apple or Google today.
Yeah, that was a big deal. I had 13 job offers when I graduated, but I had accepted the job from Xerox because that was a cool company and they were the highest paying at the time as well.
And this is going to be like a sales job or like a marketing job?
Yes, it was a sales training job. And all of the 12 or 13 of us, we all looked the same. There was mostly men, but some women. And we all basically looked the same and talked the same and had the same sort of background and education and worked hard and all of that. But I just didn't feel like there was anything unique about it. But they were paying the most. And frankly, I needed to pay off the little debt that I still had for college, and I was desperate for a new car. And so that money was a motivator. And Then, even though I had accepted this job, I took a final interview with Bullock's department store in Los Angeles because it was going to be on a Friday.
So Bullock's, for people who don't remember, was a department store, mostly in Southern California, I think, right, at the time?
Yes. And they had a bunch of people come in. I'm the last one. And the college recruiter says, I'm going to give you a job offer right now. We want you to come work for our company. And I said, wow, that's great, and I'm honored. But I think I'm going to take this other offer that I have from Xerox. He says, I want you to meet someone. He takes me upstairs, and he sits me down. And the person I'm sitting across with is a guy by the name of Alan Questrom. He was a senior vice president at the time. I was so impressed with this guy and the fact that he would take 30 minutes with me one-on-one.
Wow.
I was blown away by that. And he was 35, I think, and I was 21. And I was looking up at him and thinking, gee, I wonder if when I'm 35, I could be something like this guy.
Yeah.
And he's telling me, we're going to start you on Monday. I said, well, sir, I have to go back to school. I haven't graduated yet. He goes, yeah, okay. So Monday you start, and we're going to put you in the electronics. I said, sir, and I finally just stopped arguing with him. this guy was so passionate. And so I just ended up saying, you know what? I love these people. I love these guys. I love this company. And this culture that I'm seeing sounds like a place where I could go to work.
Wow.
And then they said, well, we took me back and he said, we're going to pay you the MBA rate, even though I had a bachelor's degree. And the MBA rate was still a little bit less than what Xerox was paying. But I took it, shook hands, and that was the deal.
And you were hired as like a trainee.
Trainee.
And at this time, I think Bullock's was owned by Federated. And if you went into a Bullock's in the late 70s, you would find everything, right? You'd find clothes and consumer electronics and watches and makeup. It was, right, like it was a one-stop shop for all that stuff.
Yes. You'd have everything that a Macy's would have today, but you would also have, you know, even yarns and fabric. And they really had a much broader assortment then. And stationery, you know, customized stationery with your, you know, initials printed on it. All those things were all part of the department stores back then.
And it was big business, right? I mean, this was these companies were like extremely profitable.
Very much so. Very big, very successful. They were the place to shop. There was far fewer specialty stores. There really wasn't the off-price business that you see today. And of course, there was no online business. So this is what people did. I mean, they made it a regular, particularly weekend event where the families would come and spend, you know, 3 hours. It was really a kind of a cultural event for many families in back in those days.
I can imagine you're kind of climbing up the ladder. You know, you start as a trainee and then eventually get greater and greater promotions. You become a VP of this division and that division at Bullock's, and then all the way to becoming the head of Bullock's Wilshire, which was their kind of upscale chain of department stores. I can imagine that you probably saw a life for yourself at Federated with all these brands, iMagnon, Bloomingdale's. You could, you know, climb up that corporate ladder and eventually, you know, retire in that company.
I did. In fact, I was so excited to be named the president of Bullock's Wilshire when I was 35. I replaced a 67-year-old, and so when I was able to snatch that position, I honestly thought that, you know, I could be there for 30 years. I thought this is going to be it. I did it. You know, I'm done.
Yeah, but in just a year, your plans change. This is like, I guess, 1988, because Federated Department Stores, who owned Bullock's, got bought out by a Canadian company. And then that company sold Bullock's, where you worked, and then some other West Coast stores to Macy's. And after the buyout, what, you take off?
Well, I didn't take off. I was actually let go.
Oh.
You know, the company had already been bought. I was getting ready to meet my new bosses, which were the CEO and the COO, chief operating officer of Macy's, were flying to meet me. Mm-hmm. I'm walking in at 7 o'clock in the morning, and my phone's ringing, and it was a reporter who I know, Ed Nardoza. He's still there at Women's Wear Daily, and he was calling me to say, Terry, what do you think about the news? And I said, what news? You've been replaced. Last night, they had a party at Macy's in New York for the person who's going to be taking over your job as head of Bullocks Wilshire.
Wow.
And my jaw just dropped to the ground. I mean,
you had no idea.
I had no idea. I thought I was doing really well and that they'd want me to be part of their company. And I was blown away, absolutely blown away. And, you know, the first thing I'm thinking of is I got two little babies running around the house. I'm scared because I don't know what I'm going to do. Honestly, don't know what I'm going to do. And so I was sort of on the bench looking, and then Neiman Marcus calls. And it was really that same person that I mentioned that I met when I was 21 years old, Alan Questrom, called me and said, don't take any jobs.
He was at Neiman Marcus?
He was about to go to Neiman Marcus. He said, because he got fired too. He lost his job. He was the vice chairman of Federated Department Stores. And so he said, you and I are going to go to Neiman Marcus. And so like 3 weeks later, we were sort of a tag team that showed up at Neiman Marcus. Mm. The business ultimately was in trouble, and it was bought by a private equity company coming in to save them as the White Knight. And within just a matter of months, Alan Questrom was recruited back to Federated because Federated was bankrupt.
So you become the CEO of Neiman Marcus.
Yeah, I became the CEO of Neiman Marcus right then, chairman and CEO.
Stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. Welcome back to Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. You were 37, and I read that when you were appointed the CEO of Neiman Marcus, there was a lot of head-scratching in the retail world and the fashion world because you were not known. Do you remember that? Do you remember that criticism or that pushback or people saying, who is this guy?
I sure do. It was definitely all of what you just described. I was not a welcome addition there, but because you can see that I'm sort of disrupting this, what had been a family-run business for decades. And what do I know? You know, most of my career was at the Bullocks department stores. Now, I was, for a short period of time, running a very luxurious business similar to Neiman Marcus. But Neiman Marcus was significantly bigger than Bullocks Wilshire and iMagnon combined. So this was a big leap for me, for sure. And there was a lot of people wondering how long I would last.
Yeah.
First thing I did was I just got out and I went to every store. I went and visited every single store, walked through the store, spent a day in each one, really understood who the people were, what our strengths were, what the product was, what was working, what wasn't working. Really got a grounds up understanding of what I thought was not working, and really listening to the people in the stores on, you know, the feet on the ground, if you will, about what the consumer is saying.
What was the challenge in 1990 at Neiman Marcus? Why was the company not performing well?
We didn't have the emphasis on certain businesses that were growing. We basically treated certain businesses the same way for many, many years. And, of course, the business had shifted. You know, at that point, beauty was becoming a much more important business. Neiman Marcus didn't even have beauty at the front door. There were things like that. I said, you know, why don't we just try this? Why don't we just try putting beauty at the front door and expanding the footprint and going after some of these new brands that we don't carry today? And, of course, this is what the consumer wanted. This is what our customer wanted. And so we were able to lift sales and things like of that nature.
This is a family company, right? Stanley Marcus, I think his grandfather, was one of the founders of this company in Dallas. And it's their company. It's their family's name on the front of the store. How was that challenging? I can imagine that, you know, if you come in with a bunch of different ideas, you know, it's not going to go over too well all the time.
It's so true. This is really early on when I was CEO. I'm walking into a restaurant and I see Stanley Marcus walking out of the restaurant. Now, Stanley had nothing to do with the store and he was a bit ostracized from the private equity firm who, you know, they didn't really talk respectfully to each other, and he just stayed away from the store. And so I see him and I said, Mr. Marcus, my name is, he said, I know who you are. Just like kind of barked at me. And I thought, oh, this isn't good. I said, Mr. Marcus, I would just love to sit down with you and just talk to you about the Neiman Marcus and about your thoughts and beliefs. There's so much to learn. I would just love to have your ear, sir. If I can just do that, may I visit you, or can we have lunch? And he said, I won't come to your store, but you can come to my office. Call me in the morning. I said, yes, sir, I will.
I mean, you were, but by the way, you were the CEO of the company.
That's right. But he didn't really have much to do with it at that point in time. So he just had his name on the door. That's the way I looked at it, which was pretty powerful.
Right.
And so I went over to see him and visited with him. And I think we ended up getting along more quickly than either of us thought we would. And I just was a sponge. This guy was brilliant. This guy, you know, invented luxury retailing as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
And so I had so much to learn. I didn't really know all of the answers. I didn't fully understand this luxury consumer and what their desires were. And so I met with Stanley on a very regular basis, and I finally got him to come over to what it was called the Zodiac Room, our restaurant at Neiman Marcus downtown Dallas. And I'll never forget that day when I'm sitting in the restaurant, Stanley Marcus, the two of us, and I'm looking around and eyes are popping out of the heads of all of the employees in the building, particularly my executives. And all of a sudden, they thought I wasn't such an idiot after all, because I was surrounding myself with Stanley Marcus. And if Stanley Marcus is listening to me, maybe they might want to do that too. And so that was a huge breakthrough. He gave me the credibility that I did not have coming in without the experience in the luxury category. And I am forever grateful, always will be.
I mean, it really sounds like, I mean, you got there and clearly you knew that people looked at you as like, who is this guy, you know? And you very consciously cultivated this sort of lion, right? And knowing that if you could learn from him, then maybe it could, you know, give you some legitimacy.
There's no question about it, and it's true. And they were right. They were right to question me. You know, I didn't have the resume that would say this is a slam dunk. Put Terry Lundgren in this job, and he's gonna knock the cover off the ball. That was not the case. And Stanley gave me the credibility to move the dial ahead, probably a year and a half or so faster than otherwise would have been possible, because he gave me the credibility that I did not have walking in there without a resume to support, you know, my vision.
Yeah.
And then a couple years later, or a year and a half or so later, I guess, I brought him into my office. You know, we were transitioning my first year, but our business wasn't great. It was just bouncing along, but it wasn't great. And I said, we need this strategy in order for us to move the business forward. And it was talking about expanding beauty, expanding the men's department, offering some price points that were more balanced. Not everything was going to be luxury at that time. And I explained all this, and he just nodded. He was quiet, and he just nodded. And after about 45 minutes or an hour of this, just the two of us, he said, okay. He starts to walk out of my office, and I said, so did you agree? You agree with my strategy? And he said, my father told me many times we have to be sure to carry water on both shoulders. Mm. And I didn't know exactly what that meant, but he went on to explain that we have to satisfy our current customer while always attempting to cultivate the new.
Sounds like you really liked working for the company. You liked the family. You stay on as CEO of Neiman Marcus for, I think, about 4 years. And then I guess it must have been your old friend Alan Questrom, because you leave in 94 to go back to Federated. Was Alan the guy that recruited you? Did he call you and say, we need you back?
Well, here's what happened. Macy's came to me and said, we want to interview you for the eventual CEO role of Macy's. And I thought, wow, what a turn of events this is.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I'm not, you know, look, I love what I do. I'm really not that interested. I'm flattered. And they called me the next day and they said, you're a candidate. And I said, wow. And they sent me this envelope. And Guy, I said, I'm not going to take this job. This is crazy. And then I opened this envelope and I said, oh, my. I've never seen numbers quite like this before. I mean, this would change my family's life. You know, this would change everything. The house I lived in, the car I drove, the future of my children's, you know, I mean, it just really was, it was very big at that time. And I just was, holy mackerel, should I at least consider this? And so I called my friend Alan Questrom.
Your former mentor.
My former mentor, and was still then my mentor. And I said, Alan, look, this is crazy. And I never even called you about this, but I saw these numbers and they're ridiculous. And he said, you've never taken a job for money. That is a lot of money, but you've never taken a job for money. Why on earth would you start now? And I said, you're 100% right. That's all I need to hear. I called them back and I said, thank you. I've made up my mind. I'm not interested. Next day, Alan Questrom calls me up and says, okay, well, look, since you were considering leaving, I think you should consider coming back to Federated Department Stores. And I said, well, I really wasn't considering leaving. I just said this package was so ridiculous, I had to just look at it, but I really wasn't considering leaving. He said, well, what if I told you that if you came back to Federated, that we could actually try to buy Macy's? And I said, now that's a very interesting idea. And long story short, it took 6 months, but he convinced me to come back. And I went in April of 1994, and we strategized. And December of 1994, we bought Macy's.
Wow.
And it wasn't a welcome bid.
Right. So you go back to Federated and help Federated buy its longtime rival Macy's, and then the two companies merge. And during this time, you're not CEO, but you're sort of being set up to grow into that kind of role eventually?
Yes. I was made the chief merchant, head of what was called Federated Merchandising. And my job was to, you know, find commonality so we could do larger buys among our various buying groups, and also ease the merge between Macy's and Federated, find the efficiencies, take out the waste, find the best talent, move them into the right jobs and roles and responsibilities, and create, you know, hopefully a successful merger between the two companies.
So I'm curious, like now, you know, in the late 90s, was there any inkling at that point that big retail stores like, you know, like Macy's might have some headwinds down the road, or at the time was it like, you know, this is great, this is going to be a 100-year, 200-year business?
Well, no, I didn't necessarily feel that way, because when I graduated from college, I told my college roommate that I was going to work for Bullock's Department Stores. He said, what are you doing going to a department store business? That's a dinosaur business. And I never forgot that. And you know, but his point was there's going to be other retailing, TV retailing. Catalogs were out. And people say, oh, they're going to just shop on catalogs. You put an 800 number at the bottom of your catalog, and you're just going to call up. That's going to kill the department stores, you know. And so there were all of these reasons why the business model of a department store was under attack for many years. And of course, the online business today is sort of the ultimate challenge, but I felt the business was under attack from many angles all through my career, and then of course when they became highly leveraged, it happened to a lot of department stores.
Yeah,
Federated was bankrupt, Macy's was bankrupt, Baumwin Teller went out of business, B. Altman's went out of business. These were largely due to having too much debt during challenging operating periods that could not be paid.
So you are working with Alan at Federated and Macy's, and 2003, you become the CEO of Federated. So essentially overseeing all these brands, including Macy's. At that time in 2003, was there a sense that this business needed to consolidate to kind of protect, you know, kind of create a moat around it? I mean,
yes.
Was there a sense that all right, let's think about how we can protect our market share our business for the next 20, 30, 40
sure.
years.
So when I became CEO and I talked about, you know, what I'd hoped we could do, my board was just genuinely surprised that I was so positive about this business that they had come to believe was under tremendous stress and was under, huge challenge and was just flattening out and not performing. So when I got into that job, it was sort of a downer. Period. And I'm coming in with such enthusiasm because I can't believe I've got this great opportunity and this great job, and I'm excited about it, and I have these ideas. And so I came with this belief that we had to change in order to, you know, move forward. And within 1 year, I said, I want to buy Marshall Field's. And they said, "What? Whoa, young man, slow down, young man." And I said, no. I said, we don't have any real estate in Chicago and Minneapolis and in Detroit. These are important markets, and we need to become a national, department store powerhouse, and we need that coverage. And so they, you know, were reluctantly agreed because I demonstrated all the math why we should be the ones who should take this company on, and we were going to be bidding, of course, against the May Company.
And the May Company, they come in with a much higher bid,
substantially higher than what I was prepared to pay. And so the May Company buys the company, and I told my board of directors that night. I called them up and I said, "We're out." And one of my directors said to me, "He said, Terry, sometimes these things have a tendency to come back around. You never know." And 1 year later, the CEO of May Company was let go. And I viewed that as an opportunity to go to my board and say, I have a new idea. I'd like to buy the May Company. And it took a little convincing back and forth, but that's exactly what we did. And I felt like we bought the company under very favorable terms.
This was one of the biggest acquisitions of all time at that
yes.
time. It was like $11 billion. Built one of the largest retailers in the world. There are going to be more than 800 stores now. And this was huge. I mean, this dropped like a bomb, right? All of a sudden, Federated, which would soon become Macy's, was going to be the biggest, one of the biggest retailers in the U.S. and the world.
Yes. One of the beauties of this deal was we had studied it, you know, so long and hard, and I got a, you know, master's doctorate degree in finance through that whole process because we bought the company for $11 billion, but we relatively soon were able to sell off $8 billion worth of assets. So I sold Lord & Taylor for $1.2 billion within a year, and I actually sold it to what is now called Hudson Bay, a company that owns Saks Fifth Avenue, but their first venture into retail was buying Lord & Taylor from us, and that was a very good sale on our part for $1.2 billion. But then I sold David's Bridal for another $800 million, sold duplicate stores because May Company and Federated had stores in the same mall and we needed to get rid of some. And so
right.
we just were able to pay down debt almost instantly. And what we were left with was we paid less for the total May Company after selling off all of those assets than what May Company paid for just Marshall Field's. And so we felt really good about the financial work that we had done in preparations for this and thought that it was not only was a big buy and a big decision, but we thought our financing plan worked beautifully.
I mean, could you argue that at this time you were sort of doubling down on the future of department store retailing, right?
Yes, I was. But I felt like we needed to have, you know, a national fashion department store, and that did not exist in the United. It didn't exist really in any country, but certainly didn't exist in America. And so I thought, you know, if we could have one brand ultimately that could capture the real estate in all of the key markets, we will quickly become not only the largest customer for all of these brands, but we'll probably have about a third of their business for the most part. And so we did that when we combined. And then, you know, eventually we made some other big bets, including collapsing divisions so that we would ultimately be able to have one buyer for, you know, each of the categories that we sold.
I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. We'll be right back. This is Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. Terry, you know, I mean, you were well aware of this as a student of business and somebody who reads the press, that you were criticized for that purchase in 2005, that you know, there were some analysts who said this is not the right move for Federated Macy's. But I wonder, if you hadn't done that acquisition back at the time with May Company, do you think Macy's would have been in a worse position today?
Oh, I definitely do, because Macy's would not have been a national player. They would not have been the largest customer for all of their brands. And you know, when you're in these roles, there's always going to be criticism. And then I would ask, how do you like the status quo? How do you like doing nothing and just continuing on the path that you've already been on? And I think not enough analysts ask that question. If they would have just stayed on the path they were on, let these other competitors come in, then what would have happened to them? And my answer to that, I didn't like the answer to that. I didn't like where that future was going to be. I could see it if I just did nothing and continued on. So taking that risk, in fact, to me, was safer than not taking a risk by not changing. That to me was an even bigger risk. So I felt passionately about not sitting on the sidelines and letting this happen to us, but rather taking a bold move and creating what I thought could be, and frankly was, you know, the largest fashion retailer in the world, basically.
I think it was roughly 2 years after the acquisition. You are facing the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression, right? 2007, 2009, financial crisis and recession. Everyone gets absolutely hammered. And retail, particularly brick-and-mortar retail at this moment, is incredibly vulnerable. Do you remember, feeling worried at that time?
Oh, yeah, very much so. This is another big financial setback that the retailers felt immediately. And I remind people that retailers knew that we were headed for a recession before the Lehman Brothers collapse and the Merrill Lynch acquisition. We saw the business being challenged and consumer pullback well before that September period. So that when that actually occurred, when the event that Monday morning occurred, it was a precipitous drop in consumption, but it was already on the decline. And so we were now saying, okay, this is going to be around for a while, and we need to have a different cost structure than the one that we've been operating with, because the business isn't going to jump back to where we've been. So I need to take costs out. That's the first thing. I said, so, but I don't want to just take costs out. I want to figure out how to take costs out and create a better mousetrap and create a more attractive company for our consumers. How do we do that? So I collapsed all of the divisions after a quick test, saved $600 million, but told Wall Street I only saved $500 million because I took $100 million and reinvested it into this new organization structure called My Macy's, which had the intent of identifying merchandise that was locally relevant to consumers. And I remember telling a story that when I was at Bullock's department stores and I was a buyer at one point in time of dinnerware, and getting a call from my department manager of the China and Crystal and Silver area in South Coast Plaza, one of our stores. And she says to me, Terry, I've got 12 brides registered for the Lennox Eternal pattern, and I'm out of stock. What are you going to do about it? So I remember checking my inventory and my paper log and driving to the Lakewood store after work that night, filling up my car with a whole bunch of China dinnerware sets and driving it to the South Coast Plaza store. And the problem was solved for the weekend. And I said, so how do we use technology to solve the problem the way we solved it back then? How do we create the local response that I just described because we want customers in South Coast Plaza to say, this is my Macy's, and it's different than Macy's in New York City. It's different than Macy's in San Francisco. It's different than Macy's Dallas, Texas. And that's where we came up with this concept of dispersing our buyers, collapsing the big divisions, and then putting a much smaller group in the market, in the field, who could tell us what we needed in each of these major hubs. And it was just like the old days. It was just like the old days when I was a buyer. And that was a huge, that became a huge hit for us.
Yeah, I'm curious, Sherry. I mean, when you are, right, you are essentially in this position where you have to be optimistic and you have to represent, the best possible face of a company because you are the CEO of the company. But probably, I mean, it didn't take a whole lot of research and reading to see that down the road, all of these businesses were going to face some huge challenges. I mean, obviously, not just Walmart and Target, but Amazon and other online retailers were really starting to make an impact by the late 2010s. And, you know, here you are atop this giant legacy company, Macy's. Was there a moment in your mind where you thought, you know, I don't know if creativity and new initiatives is ever going to really be able to compete with, you know, a website that isn't even holding inventory, you know, it doesn't have a brick and mortar store. I mean, when did you start to kind of think about that possibility?
Well, I came back to Federated, as we said, in 1994, and in 1995, we launched our first website. So we started thinking about it back then, and we had a big division in San Francisco, which, of course, when Silicon Valley was just beginning to grow and emerge as this force that we all know it to be today. And so we said we have to be in this business, and it was very slow, and it was very unsophisticated, but we were in the game. And then we kept evolving it. And so by the time 2010 had come around, we had put lots of resources into our online business. And today, Macy's is the fourth largest online retailer in America, only behind Amazon, Walmart, and Apple.
So, Terry, I mean, this is fast forwarding a little bit, but in 2017, you retired from your role as CEO of Macy's. And I know that over your time there, like sales increased by a substantial percentage, and coming out of the recession, it was the increase of something like 80%, which of course is hugely impressive. But today, I mean, you look at a company like Macy's, right, and there just isn't a whole lot of foot traffic anymore, right? I mean, I remember as a kid going into you know, Macy's or Bullock's or one of these department stores, right? There are lots of people. There are lots of employees. There's action, right? And now you walk into a department store and they're quiet. Like, it feels hard to believe that they can continue to be successful. I mean, do you think that in, you know, 20 or 30 years, department stores will still be around?
Well, let me start with this. You know, today, 80% of all apparel and shoes and accessories are sold in a physical store today. Mm-hmm. So the answer is that consumers still are in those physical stores and shopping. It's just less. And by the way, that 80% today is going to go to 70%, and it's going to keep going a bit. I don't know if it's going to go to zero in 30 years. There will be some form, I hope, of human contact in the selling process.
Yeah.
Today, my favorite transaction is the what we call click and collect, or buy online and pick up in store. And the consumer does all of her research, purchases the item that she finally decides upon, goes into the store, tries on the shoe or the apparel that she's bought, and if she bought a size 6 and needs a size 8, she makes that decision and changes it right there on the spot. This is where I think you're blending both the online and the physical store together, and I think we're going to see more and more of that.
When you think about your journey as a leader, do you think that you were born with those capabilities and capacities, or do you think you really learned how to become a leader over the course of your career?
I've been asked this question many times, and I guess I used to say, "Oh, we can all learn," and I'm still learning, frankly, now. But there has been so many examples of when I was young being thrown into a position of, "Terry, why don't you become the captain of the basketball team? Why don't you become the pledge class president? Why don't you become, you know, a CEO when you're 35, you know?" So I didn't ask for all of these roles. It just sort of found me. And so I do believe there's something, you know, that was in me that helped me, you know, become a leader. And I honestly believe that when my father cut me off in college, in those last 2 years when I had to fend for myself and I had to work on my own and get a job and perform well in school, that was such a critical development period for me. And the fact that that restaurant kept promoting me each time made me realize, hey, you know what? Wake up. You know, you can do a lot. You can do a lot more than you've applied in the past. And why don't you apply yourself and believe in yourself and go get it and just see what's out there for you? And I think that's what gave me the confidence to go and hustle for those 13 job offers that I received after college and at that restaurant. So I think it's in a lot of us, but sometimes it lays dormant until it gets woken up by examples that I've just provided.
That's Terry Lundgren, former CEO of Neiman Marcus and Macy's. In 2015, Barron's named him one of the top 30 CEOs in the world. Terry retired as chairman of Macy's in 2018. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR.